Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Welcome once again to Filthy Casuals, a podcast about video games hosted by three very kind and extremely knowledgeable boys. Thank you for joining us. My name is Tommy Dasilo. With me as always...
G'day Tommy, it's Ben Vanel here. It's great to be with you in another of our mid-COVID episodes. With not much going on, we've decided to put on our press hats and do some journalism. Mm-hmm. Joining us on this episode, as always, it's our co-journalist, the kind and knowledgeable boy himself.
I've got a different hat on today. My hat has a really big piece of paper in it that says professional historian.
Oh!
And you can't. I have to turn my head around a full 180 degrees for you to be able to read the whole mm-hmm. thing. It's a lot longer than just the word press, but it conveys exactly my intention for today, which is to professionally, history.
Tell
you
his
carry
story.
Around with you like a you carry around with you a little portable lazy Susan, and then you put that on the ground and you stand on it so that you can slowly rotate around in front of people so that they can read the hat.
Yeah. I've bought one of those hoverboard little automatic wheel things. I mean, I don't know fully what the new things are called. I'm a historian.
Yeah, you're a historian. Yeah. My hat actually.
Hoverboard. Automatic wheel things.
You know exactly what I mean, though.
Well, he's not a mechanic.
No, and when you're talking...
Yeah, fair.
I'm used to talking about the items that ancient cultures used, and you had to describe them fully in detail about what they were used for. Like, a knife was a sharp stone object. That sort of thing. So that's what I'm doing there. And then I get on that, and I try to rotate, but I fall over, and while I'm unconscious, people have a full 6 or 7 minutes to read what's on my hat while I lie there.
It's perfect. Yeah.
My hat.
What's your favorite history?
Oh yeah,
my favorite history. Personally, it's the history of video games.
Oh.
But unfortunately, this week we'll be covering the history of Pol Pot's rise to power.
Yes, that's right. The Khmer Rouge. We'll be digging deep into that. The horrible history of Cambodia in the mid 70s.
the worst horrible histories book that I read. As
horrible histories: dictators around the world.
Just some cartoons that skirted the edge of appropriateness.
I'm wearing my fedora, as you guys can see in my webcam, and I've got my little card in the side. And it says press, and then under that it says start, because I am doing some video games journalism.
Wow.
Nice.
I would, if you were a journalist who wore that, I would yell at you like I was Trump at a press briefing. I would scream at you.
And I wouldn't know how to respond. What's on your hat, Tommy?
Oh, fuck. It's actually... It's a toupee. That's a form of hat. I've decided to get into wigs in isolation. It's like, I don't have to be out in public getting ridiculed for it. By me just wearing it on conference calls with people, that's slowly acclimatizing them to it so that once I'm out in the real world, just wearing the toupee, people will be used to it and I'll be able to skirt by undetected.
I see you've still slid a piece of paper under the toupee that says press, which looks weird sticking out from what I assume is your real hair.
Yeah, it's not, you can't see the full text though. It actually, the full text is depressed.
There's a second piece of hair that covers the D at the bottom. It's kind of sweeping under. You've had to comb it.
Yeah, exactly.
Ironically, Tommy is the only one of us that is actually wearing a hat.
Yeah, that is great insight for the listener. I'm sure they could have pieced that one together by themselves, but let it be known that I am wearing a hat. I've gone for the unconventional for obvious reasons move of the hat underneath the bulky headphones. The hat being trapped, sealed over the head.
Normally, you'd wear a hat over the bulky headphones.
Yes. Normally, you'd pick one or the other, but you know, in these strange and uncertain times, I'll be damned if I'm giving you two the satisfaction of seeing the glint on my little forehead in your Zoom windows there.
The only glint I can see is the glint in my own eye here in the Zoom call, because we're talking about a subject that I really like, which is naming exactly what year certain video games came out.
Oh, you love that, don't you? That's your... It's not necessarily like anything about the games or opinions on them, although you do have them, but your special subject in Jeopardy would be, what year did that game come out?
Give me those four numbers that denote which calendar year. Roman calendar. Do we use the Roman calendar?
Gregorian, I think it's called.
No, surely Roman, because we've got Julius and Augustus in there. They wedge their way in.
Yeah, but what about May?
Yeah, I don't know who May was, but I'm assuming she was another dictator or whatever back in ancient times.
Gregorian.
Yeah, we're doing...
March is Mars, the Roman god of war. So,
And there's no month of Gregory, so I doubt he's still around. We're doing... So, I think...
Just for the listeners who are tweeting at us, we do use the Gregorian calendar. I don't know why it's called that, but...
You can't tell me which calendar to use. I use the Roman. I'm days late, regularly.
Yep. Isolation's only been going for 3 days as far as the calendar that I follow is concerned.
Oh, okay.
So I don't know what everyone's complaining about.
In the Roman calendar that I follow, it's been the month of coughing in public. So I've been following my calendar, going out and doing that as much as I can. What we're doing for the next 6 weeks is we're going to cover...
6 weeks Gregorian?
Yeah. So, okay. 12 weeks Roman. we did, so at the end of last year, we did like the best games of the last decade of the 2010s, and that was really fun. So, while there's a bit of a lull and stuff coming out, while we're kind of stuck here with, you know, bits and pieces of news, but, you know, it really feels like a trickle, we're going to open the floodgates to the history of video games and cover everything from the 1980s up through the 2000s. And I am excited to do it. I'm excited to talk absolute shit about things that I wasn't there for and completely get the facts wrong about video games from the 1970s, none of which I've played or have any interest in playing.
Were you born? You're born 1990, aren't you, Knox?
89.
Are you 90? 89, okay. You just sneak in there, you cheeky little devil.
I'm an 80s boy. When were you both born?
I was 87.
I'm 86.
Yeah. So the next 2 weeks, we're covering like the 70s and the 80s. So this is proper historian work. This is real shit. Like, we weren't alive for while this was happening, so there's no real difference between us and the people who study ancient Egypt. This is pretty much important historian work.
I mean, I'd like to think that they do more than just skimming a Google document 15 minutes before they start recording, but you're absolutely right. Clear parallels.
One of the historians had to write the Google document, but don't worry about him.
Of course. No, but I mean, you'd like to think that those historians are sharing the load is what I mean, and that there weren't any like passengers in there just kind of coasting off the hard work of one of their co-historians.
But just keep in mind that it's you don't want to undersell the work that one of the historians had to put into comb through a Wikipedia article and then copy-paste that.
Sure.
I mean, at least that historian did already have the gift, the God-given gift of knowing what year certain things came out. Yeah. That cannot be overstated or overlooked.
My first word was 1991 when somebody asked me when Super Mario World came out. I don't know why they asked that to a baby. I also don't know why they asked that. That baby would have been two at the time, I believe.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I just want to check that that came out in 1991 as well.
I think you're right. I think you're dead right.
This is a great credentials check. Fucking 1990.
Fucking 1990.
Really?
I've already.
Oh, wow. Okay, this throws the whole conceit of this episode off its axis.
Yeah. No, but it'd be 1990 Japan, 1991 Europe. So I was in Europe, so fucking fuck off.
Okay.
92 Europe, 91 America. I can... I'm recusing myself from the rest of this podcast.
This is the ancient Egyptian historians going like, nah, but time kind of worked a bit differently back then.
Yeah, so
I actually would have been right with what I was saying.
Yeah, actually, if you the way that Ramses talked about years, actually 1991 is when Ramses would have thought Super Mario World came out.
It was based on the high tide of the Nile River, not the seasons. And Gregory hadn't even invented the calendar yet, so you can't really judge things the same way.
So I'm actually right about everything because I'm in denial. That's what makes me right about everything.
Oh, Ladies
and gentlemen, welcome to...
I haven't seen the Adam Knox jaunty little dance over Zoom yet.
I haven't fucked a joke as hard as denial in a few months. So why would I have had occasion to dance?
We're going back to sort of the 70s and 80s will be the bulk of today's episode. We're not going all the way through the 80s, and we're actually starting before the 70s, but that'll be sort of, you know, that's where most of the games are for today's episode. Should we start with a little prehistory, though?
Yeah, I think I think the title will be 1980s Part 1 or something like that, but we're going to cover up to the first half of the 80s. But as is always the case with history, to understand what is going on in the modern day, you must get context from the past. And so to understand what is going on with the year 1980, we need to look further back to the year 1950-something.
The Second World War was over, and in some number of years previously, the West was booming. The American nuclear family was a big thing. Alcoholic men were coming home to their wives and yelling at them.
what a different world.
You know, classic 50s stuff.
That old nostalgia.
World War
II
was over and... World War II was over and a lot of men were thinking, God, I wish I could sit in my living room and pretend that I was in World War II and just let rip with some slurs at other people while I'm pretending to relive this experience.
Yes.
Where is the device for me?
One day we'll have the technology.
One day we will. Currently, we could offer you maybe a game of tennis. Would that help sort of... those feelings, those emotions would help
you have
that
to
sort
start
of outlet.
It's a bit like a war, I guess. Tennis is kind of a war.
Mm.
Yeah.
So that was, I in my head, Space War is like the thing people always say is like the first video game, which was like basically Asteroids, I think, but two player. And you spun your little thing around. It was on university, big fucking computers of, you know, the 60s, whenever Space War was made. But there was an earlier video game. The actual, technically the first video game was 1958, something like that.
It might have been 52.
What was it called?
Tennis for Two, I believe, is the first sort of game that actually resembles a game. Because there was other ones like... print, like they were on computers, but they had sort of like print card readouts and shit like that. So it wasn't really a game that you would lump in with what we consider a video game.
And the Tennis for Two thing, which is what it's called when you give head to Andre Agassi, is when you're 69 with Andre Agassi. I mean, he needs to be giving
He has to be giving you head at the same time.
Otherwise, it's just a nice, generous tennis is what they call it.
Yeah.
But yeah,
love October all is the other way of describing it.
William Higginbotham, Bill to his friends, was made tennis
William
for two.
Bill.
Well, you don't know that.
I'm going to call him Bill. Yeah, it was a bunch of physicists.
Could have been Higo.
It was 58. You were,
Yeah, I looked it up 6 minutes ago. But the the Brookhaven National Laboratory open house is where Pong debuted after that, right? So I'm looking at two different things. But either way, tennis for two on like an oscilloscope, two little dots making another dot bounce between them. The very first actual video game. There've been arcade games and stuff like that with physical contraptions where you like turned a wheel to move a physical car that was just on like a pin to make it dodge mechanical things coming at it. There were arcade games that very closely resembled what digital arcade games would do later.
Right.
So, but this is the first video game. Parlor games, I guess they used to call them.
Oh, yep, sure. But yeah, so an oscilloscope, for anyone who doesn't know and can't picture that, it kind of looks like a radar screen. If you've seen, like, you know, a movie about a submarine in the Cold War, it's like this circular thing with sort of grids and dots and bright lights. Very, very simple, obviously. It's monochromatic. It looks, it's strange. I didn't imagine it to look. It's like got dials and switches around the edge. Yeah. Like, it's very, very. It looks like a piece of wartime technology, honestly.
I think the oscilloscope, and I might be wrong here, and if I am, someone will definitely tell me, but I think they're generally used to measure electrical current coming into it and to be able to, like, they give you a little like a sound wave looking thing.
Right.
Like a wobbly sine wave to tell you how strong a current is, something like that. Or maybe that's just how you control the display of an oscilloscope. But yeah, very old tube technology, like a circular display. And you played a bit
The influence of the oscilloscope can be seen still in modern video games today. Anytime you have to use the left stick to control one part of the frequency and the right stick to control another part of the frequency and match them up in order to unlock a puzzle.
Yeah.
There's like a little cheeky tip of the cap to the thing that started it all.
Not a lot of people know it, but Batman Arkham Asylum technically runs on an oscilloscope in parts.
A fun fact as well for all the listeners, this is something I found out from my digging. You usually see a sine wave when he's saying hello to Newman. So...
Oh.
I'm unable to piece that together. Seinfeld?
When Seinfeld waves.
Yeah.
But sine wave would be like when you say hello to like a stop sign that's come to life or something.
Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah.
Or like...
And also he doesn't wave at Newman. He sees Newman. He just wants him out of his apartment.
Yeah,
one of the biggest things
about their relationship is that it's icy.
I've never seen the show, so
and you've never read the full title of the show.
Hello,
either.
Newman.
Never gotten far enough to realize that there's a Feld at the end of Sign as well.
You know those episodes where George is like, "Hey, Sign, what should we do today?"
Yeah, I
famously
call him Sign.
His nickname on the show. Hey, Sign.
Just a fun fact I found out in my research. That's all. Just wanted to add that to the discussion.
Yeah. Right. Well,
sorry to shoot the messenger.
Yeah. There was mainly that sort of game for the next like 20 years. So it was like, or at least 10 or 15 things made on like big fucking university computers that were all networked together and that were the only computers in the world at that time powerful enough to do anything like this. The Oregon Trail was another one that is like still talked about today that was made on a university computer.
Yeah.
That Space War one, things like that. But as you got into the 70s, arcade games started becoming a thing. And these are ones, when you get into the 70s, Pong came out in 1972, Breakout in 76, Space Invaders in 78, Galaxian in 79. Those are all ones that you still are still emblematic of the idea of an arcade game.
Yeah.
the majority of people, if you ask them to, hey, quickly draw what you think an arcade game looks like, most people would draw like Space Invaders or Pac-Man, which is to come out in 1980.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I think most people probably, I would say probably maybe the common perception is that, I guess Pong is the first video game, but like mainstream, like that actually kind of feels like a game and has some degree of like story or whatever, most people's brain probably goes to Space Invaders.
Sure.
In that it's got, you know, Pong is just like tennis, just a very, you know, crude simulation. But Space Invaders has like a, you know, kind of a conceit to it, and there's like an element of, you know, role-playing and, you know, imagining that you are this man in a spaceship or whatever it is.
Sure, and like it progresses in difficulty as you move on throughout the level. There's like the little mothership thing that'll come over the top. There's different, but that's kind of like a side quest in modern terms. There's lots of more identifiably, you know, video gamey shit happening in that. But then like the Oregon Trail is like a resource management simulator. And I was blown away that came out in 1971. That's something that, like, people were playing in schools in the US, at least, when they were, if they were our age, if we'd have grown up in the US, we'd have played the Oregon Trail back when we were kids in school in computer.
Well, that's the insane thing about, like, say, a Breakout coming out in the early 70s is there were games, like, you know, like slightly updated, but barely updated versions of it that I was playing in the early 90s as a kid. Like that sort of span of time, that from the inception of games to, yeah, like when we were old enough to be aware of, you know, the world, games did not advance in a significant way, at least on the surface.
Right. Or there was still, I guess it had turned, like Breakout and Space Invaders and Pong and that sort of shit had turned into being a nostalgic thing by the time I was a kid. So they were still around, but in the same way that you like fucking SNES minis or your PlayStation classics or whatever are around now, it was maybe closer to that.
Yeah, you'll still today like be in a fish and chip shop and see one of those like tabletop machines that's got like 20 of the games loaded on it.
Yeah.
See someone chucking 20 cents in to have a game of Space Invaders.
Well, because
it's still out there.
And most of these, I don't think they were really dedicated arcades or anything at this point. They probably were in some places, but a lot of these were in like the corner of a pub. And that sort of thing. They were put in there the same way like a pinball machine would be, where it was a little entertainment thing in a general entertainment venue. Video games weren't really their own kind of unique or separate thing that people would focus on in the way that they do now.
Yeah, yeah. I know my dad.
It's funny that...
I know my dad was like one of the people who was really into pinball, and he was born in 1960, so... by the time he was getting into pubs, it was 1974 and he was playing, but he was like, you know, played pool and played pinball and played Pong. Like he was super into those sort of things. Like you mentioned parlor games before, Knox, but like pub games, something to play, you know, while you're waiting for your palmer to be served. They were just like chucking I wonder how much they cost to play actually. I don't know.
I don't know, but there's nothing better than going out on a Saturday night in 1978 and having a bit of a parlor and a palmer.
Oh, yes.
God, I would love to go to a pub with a fucking anything there. Who cares about... Fuck the video games. I would love to go to a pub again.
Yes.
How good would that be?
I'd love to be in a room that's not this one. Yeah, that's sick. Yeah.
Wouldn't it be nice to just interact with anyone? Anyway, the 70s had... some video games sort of, and more significantly to like the modern day, I would say, is that the Atari 2600 was launched in the 1970s. That motherfucker came out in like 77, I believe. And so that there had been other home consoles at that point. I mean, maybe we're getting away from ourselves here. Well, maybe we'll talk about that later. But a lot of stuff started happening in the 70s is the point. So to talk about the 80s, you have to talk about the 70s. If you dare fucking say anything about the 80s to me without talking about the 70s first, I'm walking away.
Can I just say, it's very funny that like one of the first game, as we talked about before, is Tennis for Two. Mm. First of all, that's just tennis. It's just called tennis.
Yeah.
That's default tennis.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so then one of the very next ones that gets made is Pong. Essentially the same thing. Like I imagine anyone on the ground at the time going... okay, so is this all we're going to ever use this technology for? Yeah. Imagine if people had never gotten out of that rut, and we're still now, we've got these like, we've all got like an Xbox and a Switch and a PlayStation 4, these like powerful consoles, but all that's coming out on it is just different tennis games. It's still like people scratching their heads going, there must be some other way to use this tech.
There's the fact as well that like the first game was Tennis for Two, and then Pong came along, completely stole its ideas and got way, way bigger. Things are still exactly the same as that in video games today.
Yeah. Pong's Fortnite.
Pong is the Fortnite to Tennis for Two's PUBG.
Yeah, completely.
It's just always been the way it is.
Activision released Badminton for the Commodore 64. Yeah, and everyone just played that for about 3 months, I guess.
You have to buy a second arcade game to unlock the badminton rackets. You have to have the two machines sitting there next to each other. The second one was called... I can't think of a thing for DLC that could have worked in an old time, but you get what I'm doing here.
You get it. Yeah.
So, this was the like peak of arcade games in the public consciousness, really, because you had... So, there were like these home consoles coming out, like the Magnavox Odyssey, which... Mm-hmm. I have really very little knowledge of any of these types of very old pre-Atari consoles. A lot of them played just one game on them. So you'd buy a thing, or it might have like six games that you could switch between, and one of them used a gun and whatever. Yeah. But you had stuff sort of starting to bubble up. But when the 80s hit, arcades got massive. So we've talked about the 70s enough for me. That'll do. We've paid it its due.
Yep.
It's time to move into the bright lights and the loud beeps of the 1980s arcade.
Time to take the bell bottoms off, fellas, and put on the acid wash.
Yeah, acid wash jeans.
Leather pants? Yeah. Were leather... Was the 80s?
Depends where you were going in the 80s, open, I think.
Yeah.
The open leather jacket with nothing on underneath.
Yeah, the classic 1980s arseless chaps.
Yeah.
Well, they never go out of style.
They're timeless.
Yeah.
If the photos I've seen of my parents in the 80s are anything to go by, the highest fashion was the strap-on. Everyone was wearing them back then.
Yeah.
But yeah, so 1980 rolls around, and in comes he is using his mouth, I guess, to propel himself. In comes the big boy of arcade games, Mr. Pac-Man. Comes along in 1980, and this is when, because I think Space Invaders was maybe the one that was responsible for, like, there was a coin shortage in Japan, I believe. People were playing Space Invaders so much that they were like, they started running out of whichever coin it was that ran that machine. Then Pac-Man came along, and they called it Pac-Man Fever at the time because it was this huge sensation. Everyone was into Pac-Man. They made like those... You remember in the 1980s how they made like those gimmick songs about just things that were big at the time? There were like joke songs about Star Wars, and there was one that was like Star Trekking Across the Universe.
Yes.
On the Starship Enterprise under Captain Kirk. It was the time when Weird Al could get away with it. He didn't do any of those as much, but like it was just a bunch of those gimmick
TikTok songs. TikTok of its day.
Yeah. There was a song called Pac-Man. People were big into fucking Pac-Man. And you can see why. When you put it in the context of these games that have come before it, Pac-Man is a bit of a leap forward.
Absolutely. I also think, I mean, we haven't comprehensively covered every game from the 70s, but...
There's no way to
Pac-Man,
do it.
No.
We'll never do it.
There's no way anyone could do it, so why bother trying?
Why bother even making a podcast that was about any decade of gaming? Because it's too much.
It's too hard. None of those games, at least, that we talked about, and especially the biggest ones, had a character, like a personification or a marketable thing at the forefront. Like Space Invaders had an idea and a style to it. Pong had nothing, like we've said, really. Oregon Trail was, you know, its own. It's a setting and it's a historical game. But Pac-Man, was the first game to have a mascot.
Yeah.
Yeah. Nice little painting of him on the side of the cabinet. Like, you know, that thing where the graphics are so simplistic that, yeah, on the cabinet you can really wild out with the visual style and, you know, really, really give that impression. Like, I always remember that as a kid, like seeing the, you know, walking up to the machine and seeing those representations on the side of it and then sort of bit like kind of it helping to paint the picture in my head a bit, but kind of being like, man, I wish it actually looked like this. I wish I could actually see this little guy running around instead of just a shape. It's also, I think, it might be one of the first games that has a sense of real AI to it. Like, Space Invaders is kind of on a pattern, more or less, isn't it? Whereas the way these ghosts kind of chase you around, that probably felt at the time pretty revolutionary in terms of the difficulty and the challenge.
Sure, I can agree with that, because, like, Galaxian kind of had it was the same as Space Invaders, but with... they would have different little enemies up the top and they would do different sort of attacks. But they were kind of pre-baked in the same way.
Mm.
But yeah, Pac-Man was... It changed every time you played it because, like you said, those ghosts were... they've got really, really simple AI routines. I remember reading about it once. I don't remember exactly what they are now. But like one of them is just programmed to always try to get to the block in front of you. One of them is always programmed to try and get to three blocks behind you and then go away. So stuff like that. But they've got really simple behaviors that when you put the four of them together creates this, you know, very emergent experience that I agree.
And you're in these little narrow corridor kind of things, like they're chasing you down it, which all the other ones take place, like Space Invaders, and, you know, you're in this bigger space and you can kind of dodge out of the way a bit more freely. But that feeling in Pac-Man of, like, if you just take a wrong turn and you're, like, cornered by one of these ghosts, it's just such an intense feeling.
Right.
Which, yeah, unique for the time.
You could see, and it might be a long bow to draw, but you could make a line appear between Pac-Man and the likes of Doom or even, like, a Resident Evil or whatever, where you've got that sense of being chased and the claustrophobia and all that. So, yeah, I could see that. Mm-hmm. And then having the addition of, so you get in the little pellets, but then when you get those big pellets and you can eat the ghosts, that's a great thing to put in there where you suddenly have power over these enemies. It's a good game. And it fucking blew up enormously over the rest of the 80s. You get Miss Pac-Man and Baby Pac-Man and all these other ones. And a lot of Namco's arcade games were built off of that same board that they used for Pac-Man. So if you look at a bunch of other Namco video games, you can see that they look similar to Pac-Man in the way that the graphics are presented. So it was definitely a big hit up. 1980 as well in the arcades, you had like Missile Command and Battlezone was... I remember my dad telling me that Battlezone was like incredible at the time because it had the first that he'd seen at least sort of 3D... They were vector-based graphics where... Have you seen Battlezone with, like, the lines that draw... They're, like, little wireframe models that make these tanks appear.
Yeah, this is sick. Like, sort of green lines on black. Yeah, polygonal vector graphics, 3D, essentially.
Yeah, and you're inside of a big tank, and I believe the cabinet for this had you sitting there with, like, a big joystick and rotating it around. Because that was the other thing that I do miss about the arcades and the way that they don't exist today. And you got more and more of this as the 80s went on. But the big fucking cabinets where you would have to sit down and pretend to be in a race car. Like in 1982, pole position came out, which was one of the, I think maybe the first kind of behind the back racing games. And you would sit there in your cabinet and you would drive around and you'd love 1982. You'd just be all about the year 1982. Duran Duran, who's that, I think? You wouldn't even know at the time. What a time.
But just touching on, Tommy, your fascination and love of the Pac-Man arcade cabinet itself and the drawings on it and the sort of that extra level of imagination it sparked. I looked up the Pong cabinet, the original Pong cabinet. Now, this is the first game. It's incredibly simplistic. If you're making a cabinet for it, you can put anything on that cabinet you want to maybe evoke, you know, tennis or a fun party. It's a blank yep. cabinet. It's just a wood grain blank cabinet with like a mustard front plate. It couldn't be less evocative.
You don't even have to cook anything up. It's all there for you.
Yeah.
The iconography, the style, the colors, it's all just there. Space Invaders, you've got to, what can we make an alien look like? You've got to do a bit of work. But it's Pong. It's all laid out for you. That's a shame.
To be fair, coming out of the 70s, fuck, they loved a bit of wood grain back then.
Yeah, it looks like a car that my dad would have owned. It really does.
Yeah. So does the original Atari consoles as well.
Yes.
Wood grain as hell.
Yeah.
And it looks pretty cool.
Bring that back.
Yeah. Why not?
Mm.
Well, because it doesn't actually look good. The fucking wallpaper that you had in the 70s was so awful. You know that the just like faded color, shitty pattern thing. I don't even know what the type of pattern it's called, but you know what I mean. Go watch that 70s show. You'll see it. But further into the 80s, Nintendo starts really amping up their game. I think they put out some shit beforehand, little individual consoles or something like that Nintendo had put out early days. But in the 80s in the arcade, they started really hitting big. They put out Donkey Kong. They put out the original Mario Brothers, Balloon Fight, Punch-Out. You got all of those sort of things coming out of Nintendo in the 80s, so they're big dicks swinging around.
Is Donkey Kong, that's got to be their first big hit, right?
I think so, yeah.
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 And Donkey Kong, in a lot of ways, was the one that kind of became the big sort of public consciousness game following Pac-Man. Then you had Frogger coming out, you had things like Dig Dug and Burger Time, these pretty big
Burger
sort
Time
of...
Burger Time is awesome.
It's so good. It's such a fun game.
Yeah.
So the arcades were like pretty innovative. Stuff like Q-Bert came out, which was fucking weird, and I still don't understand what you meant to do in Q-Bert to this day.
It's more of a puzzle game, right?
I've never gotten it. I've never understood it.
I think you're jumping around a 3D pyramid just trying to cover every square, and there's enemies, I think. I'm not entirely sure, but I watched a video of it before, and I think that's what you were doing in it.
That's the magic of Q-Bert, though. No one knows. if you're one of the Q-Bert players.
And he's swearing?
Yeah. Q-Bert's got that little asterisk right next to Q because he said fuck.
Q-fuckbert.
Q-fuckbert, yeah.
Laser
or maybe it's Q. It could be spelled Q-U-N-T. And maybe the U-N-T is...
Oh, yeah? Like cunt.
Yeah.
Nice. You had some of those Laserdisc games start coming out around this time as well, which I think are really cool in like a, you know, historical artifact kind of way. Quarter Horse was the first one. I don't know much about what that is, but I think most people would recognize like Dragon's Lair and Space Ace.
Yes.
And those kind of just hit the button when it flashes on the screen or else a movie will play of you dying. Pretty simple, pretty shit. But Laserdiscs in general, I think, are so fucking funny that... these existing at the time, like that big fucking disc, and they coincided with the silliest era of movies as well. So I've always thought if I was like a multi fucking millionaire or whatever, I would get a Laserdisc collection and Lethal Weapon every day, Laserdisc edition. That'd be so good. But those Laserdisc games were kind of cool.
Oh my god.
And then you had...
I'm just looking up the cabinet for Quarter Horse.
Yeah, me too. Sorry. Yeah.
I got distracted by needing to find out what the fuck this is.
Yeah, same.
That is a shit-looking cabinet.
It's awful. And the game looks even worse.
Well, I guess that's why Dragon's Lair was the one that came along. Here we go. Tommy's sharing his screen. And it's forced me to go full
look at
screen
that.
Mode.
Yes.
Yeah.
Look at this.
It's another gross looking
three
kinda,
models to choose from.
Yeah. wooden cabinet. Not appealing to the eye.
Yeah.
No.
And it just looks like a horse racing, like TV vision of a race, of a horse race. I guess you just like bash on the whip control, probably.
And it probably costs a quarter. But yeah, those Laserdisc games were kind of like cool as a side thing, but you know, they weren't the main thing. Something big that started happening around this time as well is you got licensed games. So there was an arcade game for Tron that was massive, and then a Star Wars arcade game that I've actually played that is like the 3D vector graphics again, similar to Battlezone, and you go through like the fucking trench run and whatever. You do some Star Wars.
Oh, yes.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. I've seen vision of that. Well, I mean, looking at Battlezone earlier, it made me think immediately of Tron. What year? I'm just going to look up. Tron came out 2 years after Battlezone the game came out, the film of Tron.
Yeah, and I think the arcade game came out just before the movie did, even.
Right, yeah, right.
And I guess with the Tron arcade game, I think you were doing the motorbike racing, where you'd leave the sort of solid colored walls behind you, and you crash into them or not.
What do you reckon the development time is on these games back in the day?
Well, for these arcade ones, probably, you know, not a tiny short amount of time, but we'll talk about later how it was pretty easy to shit out a bunch of 80s video games in the early 80s. Yeah, I don't think it was... I mean, obviously it was nowhere near comparable to what you do today. A lot of these games had one person make them or five people or whatever.
Yeah. I guess the hardest part of something like a Donkey Kong would have been that, like, you're doing kind of this thing for the first time. So probably a big bulk of it is just the trial and error of just testing it and being like, oh, shit, this makes him fall through the floor.
Well,
okay,
with arcade games as well, they've got to have, like, hardware engineers working on it because you're physically making a new board.
Yeah.
So it was a very different process to making a game today. Making arcade games in general was different because they had... I've started reading about this recently for some reason, but like, so that they companies, so for example, Namco made the Pac-Man board that was for Pac-Man, but then a bunch of other games that Namco put out after that were based on that same board and can just run on the same board. So they were manufacturing a Pac-Man board and then reprogramming it to be fucking whatever else they wanted to put out. Similar with Capcom did a similar thing with, I don't know if 1942 was the board, but they had these thing called like the Capcom Play System. CPS 1, 2, and 3, and that would be the jumping off point for every game that came out during a certain era of Capcom putting out arcade games. And yeah, 1942 came out in 84, and that was one of the first
funny to think of shoot 'em up games. Sorry.
No, I'm just talking about Capcom's start. Capcom started at some point. There you go.
Yep.
And they had a big hit with 1942.
Confusingly, it came out in 1984. I mean, yeah. Like, what year is it?
Well, currently it's 2020. I did have to think about that for a second. Yeah, I nearly said 2019. God, imagine. Mm. Wouldn't that be nice?
Take me back.
Anyway, sorry, Tommy. What were you going to say?
It's funny to think of... it taking a little while to work out that they could reuse boards for multiple games. As you know, as if it's a comparable thing like in making movies and just like building a new camera every time you make a new motion picture.
Like, I get, yeah. Just computers and shit were different at the time. Like the rapid change in how computer technology worked from 1980 through to like 2000, those two decades in particular was fucking enormous. And probably through to 2010 as well. I feel like, and maybe I'm wrong, but things have like slowed down a little or just gotten to be, there's been a very obviously viewable upgrade path that you could have quite handily predicted in 2010. But to be in 1980 and to imagine what things would have been like in 2010, 30 years later, is unbelievable.
Yeah, I guess the fact that like you could be in 1980 and not be able to accurately predict what things would be like in 1983.
Maybe that's fucking crazy as well, because like we kind of just mentioned, to be in 2019 and predicted how 2020 would have gone, way of doing it. And if I hadn't been able to do it, I would have behaved differently for but I would have become a karate champ so that I could learn to fight. Speaking of which, Karate Champ was like the first fighting game that ever came out, basically. So I think that's
Right. Mm-hmm. Because I think when you ask people to, like, I reckon if you ask people now to name what the first video game was, if they're under 30, I don't know what they would name. Maybe they would guess Mario Brothers. Maybe they would guess Street Fighter. Because those are, and yeah, I guess if you're a bit older, you say Pac-Man, maybe you guess Pong. But something like Street Fighter has come to symbolize video games.
Especially with arcade stuff, and especially with fighting games. Like Street Fighter 2 is the one. So it's ages until fighting games become the thing that they are going to become. And Karate Champ, just significant for being one of the early examples of that. So you had a lot of innovation, a lot of different games that are all trying to kind of have their own thing and stick out from one another. Like the difference between Frogger and Dig Dug and Dragon's Lair is huge. Compared to if you compare Call of Duty and Battlefield and PUBG and whatever these days, like maybe the bigger games that there are, they're all trying to do different versions of the same thing. But back in these early arcade days, everyone's kind of trying to come up with their own idea, do something new, figure out a new thing, a new path to walk down.
Everything new that comes out is like a new genre. And yeah, that's the thing I've always loved about these old games is like the idea of the developers sitting down and thinking like, okay, what's a hook? It's just basically like one idea, one really simple idea that's really easy to latch onto that then just, ratchets up in difficult. Frog is one of my favorites of all time. Mm. Frog is so good.
And then compare that to fucking Pong, you know, things change and people are being very creative with it now. And I guess, the amount of effort it takes to make a big arcade game versus what at the time was a little bit easier, making a home console game or a computer game, is responsible for what happened in like the home console market in the coming years. Because, separate to the arcade, the home console market is going massively, being led by the big old Atari 2600. Big dog.
Atari still got all that bank from inventing Pong, right? Atari published Pong, so they have this pile of money, and they decide, we're going to be the innovators in home video games, and bang, the 2600 hits the market.
And they did it. Like, there were a bunch of them, things that you haven't even fucking heard of these days, called like the Fairchild Channel F and the Bally Astrocade. Like, they had competition. Things that I have heard of, called the Intellivision and the Vectrex, things like that. There were other people trying to get the same market, but Atari had that brand name recognition. You're right, Ben, from Pong and stuff like that. I think Centipede was them as well. Missile Command as well, maybe. So people knew them. And then they did the swap the cartridge out. You can buy a new game. You've got your console and a new game is contained on a cartridge. They all work with this console and this controller. It's got wood grain. You fucking love that at the moment. Here you go.
Yeah.
Have either of you ever played much of an Atari 2600?
I don't think I've ever seen one in the flesh. No.
Yeah.
I believe we owned maybe one of the later ones. Was like a 50-something or a 60-something hundred.
They did a 5200 and a 76 or something hundred. 7800,
it might have been
maybe
the 7800, because we also had one of those like big 5-inch B drive, floppy drive peripheral attachments for the Atari that we had.
Right. Well, you might have had like an Atari ST or something then, because they had home computers as well. That were
right.
So they met. Yeah, I think the Atari ST was their equivalent to things like the Commodore 64 and whatever, which is a whole separate thing that we'll talk about later. All the computers and stuff in the '80s. But
this was definitely a console, though.
Right.
This plugged into the TV, and it just happened to have this massive library of games that we got from our cousins. Whether or not these were legitimate games is up for debate. And I think if I was to try to debate that they were legitimate, I would lose the debate. But we had an Atari at home that plugged into the TV, and I played a bunch of games. I played Pitfall. I played a lot of the classics, and loved it. I think this was a time before we had bought a Nintendo console. This was all we had apart from like a really, really shitty computer. And it was it was just incredible. It was amazing.
Yeah, plugging that thing into the RF port of your TV, into the aerial socket, tuning it in.
Oh yeah.
Was definitely really cool. And yeah, I had the exact same situation where some cousins gave us an Atari 2600 way after it being relevant. And we had Combat, which was a fucking great game. Combat was a two-player game where it had all these different modes on it that you like set. There was a mode button on the console and you'd set different game types by pushing that. And so you could like play as two tanks shooting at each other, planes shooting at each other, different amounts of planes. One could be like a massive bomber plane and then the other one was like three little fighters. It was really, really fun. And that was one of the first games that came out with it. There was a game called Adventure, which a lot of people consider to be like the first kind of RPG or adventure game. You're just a little block moving around and trying to find keys in a maze and then bring them back to a lock. Pitfall was great. Activision put out a lot of good things during the Atari 2600 years.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't know this about Activision. They used to be people who worked for Atari and they got sick of it, splintered off, made Activision, and they were like one of the first big third-party publishers for consoles. And it hadn't really been done much before.
Mm.
They started putting out fucking tons of stuff. Some of it good, some of it pure dog shit. And that was a big problem with the 2600 is that, like you were saying before, I think, Tommy, it was so easy to make games. It was so easy to put them out there. You could do it so quickly and so cheaply that people absolutely fucking did and flooded the market with these dog shit games and like a lot of really poorly made ports of arcade games like Pac-Man that fucking sucked on the Atari. Were quite expensive at the time as well.
And there's no real like copyright being enforced with this kind of stuff. So aren't people just like making their own versions of stuff that already exists and getting it onto the shelves in an effort to just like basically trick people into buying their shoddy, rushed out, inferior version? It's too many games. All of a sudden there's too many games on the shelves.
It's the fucking Wild West at this point. Like you'd buy fucking Pac-Mate at your computer shop and you'd be like, this is Pac-Man. Like, no, he's Pac-Mate, he's Australian Pac-Man, he eats fucking beers or whatever.
There
was a lot of just awful shit put out on it. There's a game called Custer's Revenge where you play like an old west fucking I guess cowboy guy, and the point of the game is to sexually assault Native American women. And then at some point people are going like, maybe we're sick of this. We're sick of all these games you're putting out here.
Yeah.
That game particularly is worth bringing up because it led to a lawsuit about that game and how easy it was for people to be able to put out third party sort of licensed products.
Right.
So that game in particular, because it created a bit of an uproar, as you can imagine, led to some restrictions on who could put out games. But the damage was already largely done by Atari itself. It's a very famous thing with them putting out E.T. and printing millions and millions of copies of it, the game being shit, no one wanting to buy it. And then for some bizarre fucking reason, after I'm assuming like a 12-hour meeting and empty Chinese delivery boxes everywhere, someone goes, why don't we just fucking bury them in the desert? And they meant it sort of as an extreme joke. But then everyone's eyes kind of lit up and they fucking did that. A bizarre ending to that whole site. Like, the Atari 2600 burned very brightly and then everyone fucked it off and got sick of it all at once, seemingly, to the point where they called it a video games crash and thought the industry itself was dead.
Yeah.
Yeah, so before the next wave comes in, there's a lot of problems. Because retailers have been burnt. Retailers are all of a sudden left with all these games that no one wants anymore. They were flying off the shelves and now they've just got all this excess stock that they can't shift. So they're all a bit like, fuck video games. We don't want anything to do with it. This was fun while it lasted, but this little fad is over now.
And exactly. And you can see how it seemed like a fad because it had only been going for a few years. There was like the fucking dumbass songs about Pac-Man and whatever. I could absolutely see at the time people going like, yeah, cool, we had our 3, 4, 5 years of fun, but these are shit now. And they were right. Video games had turned shit on the biggest medium for them, which was the Atari 2600. And there was just so much fucking schlock being put out that they were completely just... People... It made sense for people to get sick of them.
Totally. From, it, like, the year 1971 to the year 1984, we'll say, there was maybe, like, 10 essential games that you really would enjoy playing, right? Like, there were... There was, like... those 4 or 5 genuinely unique ones that invented genres almost. And then there were some other sort of fun variations. But for the amount of like games that were released and shoveled onto shelves, the percentage that were worth playing was like 1 or 2%.
By the nature of what these games were at the time too, I think there's an argument to be made that you would just get sick of doing the same sort of high score chasing, like, oh, I've got to learn how to master this one. It, even though they were all different genres and different forms of that type of gameplay, there's a reason that now arcade games is like a style or a genre of games, because these things are all asking the same thing of you, which is to be put in this challenging position and to figure out the pattern usually that gets you through it. And even though they're all different variants of that, they all are similar in that way.
And at that point as well, there were a lot of games that were just like, what if we recreated billiards as an arcade game or like a video game? What if we recreated tennis? And it's like, well, this isn't actually more fun than playing these physical games in person with your friends. It's a novelty and it's cool, but yeah, you're right. This is not a sustainable pastime at that point, it wasn't at least.
No, and like along the side as well, worth pointing out that Nintendo had started putting out their Game & Watches, which were kind of the among the first handheld video games as well, which is kind of cool. I remember I had a Bomb Sweeper and I had Popeye, given from the same cousin.
Ooh.
And they were pretty cool.
I never played a Game & Watch.
I had Greenhouse and I had Snoopy Tennis that Nintendo made.
Snoopy Tennis for Two is when you suck off Snoopy while you're...
And Greenhouse, which was one of the... Because there were two. There were like the single screen ones and then there were the ones that kind of like a clamshell thing that opened up that went across two screens that were... That, again, for the time was just like, oh my God, this is incredible.
And when they brought the DS out in like, what, 2004 later, everyone's like, oh, the fucking Game & Watch is back. That's cool.
Yeah.
So Nintendo were plugging along on the side with those things. And working on their Famicom, which they put out. And that is the thing that kind of stopped the video game crash from happening properly, is that while people were sick of these consoles, along the same or around the same time in the 80s, but off to the side, you had video games on home computers. Now this, the PC master race back in the day with those enormous... I cannot help but picture someone with enormous square, but like rounded square glasses. And they've got the very thick lenses in them. They've got like sort of that haircut where it all seems to sprout from the middle of the top of their head.
Yes!
Do you know what I mean? They're wearing like beige pants, beige shirt, beige belt. They've got
they're on safari.
Yep. But those games and the computers that were around in the early 80s kind of got the concept of the video game through that little patch in a way, because there was still proper innovation there. And like the early origins of the concept of an indie scene.
Yeah.
Because with these early computers, that whole idea of like a bedroom programmer or whatever... That's where these came from. This is stuff like... So the Apple II was one of the first kind of big, easily acquirable, like consumer-level products that you could write code on. I remember I bought an Apple II from a school, like some high schools had a garage sale and were giving away a bunch of old like school equipment. They had an Apple II there and I bought it for like $40 with a whole bunch of fucking floppy disks. And
oh wow,
it was kind of cool. It had like a whole bunch of text adventures, and, like, you know, fucking tell Garfield what day it is. If it's not Wednesday, but it was yesterday, and it's not Friday, but it'll be Friday tomorrow, what day is it? Then you type in Thursday, and Garfield will be like, oh, I don't mind Thursday. But yeah, it was one answer he did not want to hear, I'll tell you that much. But it was all, it, you know, pretty simple shit like that. I think big things people know are like Zork.
Yeah.
Yep. Yep.
One of the worst names for any entertainment product that's ever been made. But then you had things like the Commodore 64 and the ZX Spectrum come along, and they were hugely successful computers that also could play games. And that was the big thing, is that the Atari 2600 didn't have any other function, but then these computers did. So it was easier to keep them in people's houses and keep people's interest in them whilst also putting out these games.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, they're not seen as a toy. They're seen as a... Yeah, like exactly. If you're a savvy tech person, yeah.
An international business machine, if you will.
It certainly helped me to persuade my parents to get a computer. It's for work. You guys can type stuff up on it, and there's word processing. And yeah, there happens to be a game on there called Ski Free, where you try to get past the Abominable Snowman. But, you know, like, this is a legitimate piece of technology for a family. It genuinely helped a lot of people, I think, normalize video games.
And the early 80s is the first time that that having a computer in your house was really possible. Like, these were relatively cheap given what computers had been up until that point. So you could feasibly have a computer in the home, which was mind-blowing at the time, I assume. I was not alive, but I assume that would have been cool. Some of the big early, like, computer games, Wolfenstein, the original one, which was like a stealth game.
Yep.
Zork and those sort of text adventures. You had like Ultima and Wizardry and a bunch of other similar kind of computer RPGs that were like adaptations of Dungeons and Dragons and shit. They were very, very big at the time. And also, like, Ultima and Wizardry came out, were developed in the US, and then were the direct influence for what created the genre that is now called a Japanese RPG. Final Fantasy and that sort of stuff was based off of people over in Japan playing these Western games, which I think is kind of cool. Elite was another big one where you could explore space, but nothing really happened, and that would later lead to No Man's Sky. But you could...
Oh, yeah. Very proud of himself.
That was brave. Thank you. I was very brave then. The big thing about these, though, I think, and the thing that got people through it, was that they were easily and cheaply distributable. You could send them on a tape, just like a cassette tape or a floppy disk or whatever. They were very cheap to publish, and literally anyone could code them. And so they did. Like, Rareware started by making games for the ZX Spectrum back in the day, and it was just like those two brothers doing it in their bedroom. And there was a bunch of people like that where it was like one person would make a game. Prince of Persia, which is years away, but that was programmed by one person.
Right.
So, yeah, the modern concept of an indie game that seemed like this kind of new thing that, like, wow, look at what modern technology's allowed us to do, was actually just a resurgence of an older thing from 20 years before indie games kind of started becoming a thing, which is kind of cool.
Yeah, and the accessibility of the tools, which I guess kind of drifted away for a bit. So part of the crash happening in games surviving means that they need to sort of start clamping down on the freedom of the availability of those tools. But I think that's kind of what we're going to cover in next episode.
Right. Because I think with a lot of these sort of things, and more so with the future episodes, I don't particularly think there's any point in us talking about the pros and the cons of Donkey Kong. That game is so simple and so well known that I don't think we have anything to add there. So this episode in particular is like, here's how we got up to the point where these much more significant sort of, or like much more modern examples of games came out. Because everything that happened pre sort of the NES does seem like a very different era to everything post the NES.
Yeah, so I think a broad definition of video games from the era we've covered is sort of like a new and exciting interactive experience where your actions cause things to happen on a screen. By the end of that experience, you will have revealed an 8-bit drawing of a naked woman. I feel like that encompasses all of gaming up until about 1984.
Yeah, that's pretty much. And like, if you're talking about the history of movies, no one's going back and rewatching fucking the story of the Kelly Gang for fun.
Mm.
It's significant historically, but by the time you get to Gone with the Wind, you're like, okay, movies exist now. Let's get going.
Yep.
Yeah. So we're still in that sort of formative time. I've never touched a Commodore 64 or ZX Spectrum. I would absolutely love to fuck with those computers, and you can emulate all of this stuff these days.
Mm.
But so the general sort of up until the mid-80s, video games were, like you said, Ben, this new thing that blew up. People experimented a bunch, but then sort of lost their direction with. People weren't quite sure where to go with it. There were a few innovators on like computers, independent people, but as an industry, it wasn't really clear what direction to move in or who was going to spearhead that direction. And next week, I think we'll be doing a lot of talking about Nintendo for once.
Yeah, now you can find out why Tommy's so obsessed with them.
Up until this point, it's been, the end of this little chapter is that the experience of games are, for the most part, this very repetitive, like, high score focused, with some exceptions, but in talking about the strength of the arcades and everything that comes out is kind of just like, a little simple idea where you're just trying to be a bit more successful at it each time, and it like resetting at the start, and then so in terms of working out where it should go from here, then there's like a big leap to be taken, and the bits of these RPGs kind of filtering in. But
we need to take a leap, do we? Well, then how are we going to take a big leap? We'd need some sort of a jump man. Tune in next week, folks, and you'll understand what that was about.
He was in Donkey Kong. We already talked about that.
Well, he's coming back. He's on his own.
Oh, okay. Yeah, sweet.
He is, but he's also sort of not. Like,
oh, okay. Yeah, right.
Nah, okay, he's coming back. It's confusing.
That's a confusing transition.
We'll have a little bit to talk about.
Okay. Yeah. No. I think.
But yeah. So up until the mid-80s, video games existed, but. Yep. Modern video games, I believe, you've got all these arcade things, but the modern concept of what I consider to be a video game still does not properly exist just yet.
Yes. Yep. Yeah. And next week, we will talk about the earliest examples of those games. I'm really looking forward to it.
Yeah. We've got the ball rolling, and for the next 6 weeks, it's going to tumble down that hill and crush every bit of massive news that's definitely going to happen during the next month and a half that we will be... it would be crazy of us not to address, but fuck off.
Yeah, we want to do this.
All right, well, let's wrap it up for another week, guys. Thanks very much for listening. We will see you next week for part two of the 80s. Head to filthycasuals.com.au for the links to our social media stuff. We've got the Patreon. You can get an extra episode of the show every week. If you'd like to chip in a little money to support the show, it's very much appreciated by all three of us. We've got the Let's Plays up on our YouTube channel. We've got our premium episodes on Bandcamp. You can find all that stuff at filthycasuals.com.au. We'll see you next time, and as we say here at the end of every episode of Filthy Casuals,
we started this podcast as pack boys, we leave as pack men.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.